Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at #NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/BehindTheRacketPod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now,
Jason Kubler has been waiting a year and a half to get on the podcast since he won Little Rock.
Jump me.
I'll try.
Another slam, I guess.
Yeah, right. Someday Jason Kubler will join us on the podcast, but the more important person that's joining us on the podcast right now is Robert Galloway, the pride of Wofford. Thank you for doing this. Yesterday, obviously lost in the first round here at the Australian Open. Let's start there so we get that part of this out of the way. These moments for you have become clearly very special. Obviously a heartbreaker for you. How do you, at this stage of your career, how do you process the whole thing when you, the accomplishment of being here, what you've gone through, and then a tough one like that?
Yeah, I mean, just being here, there's a lot of pride. Like, I've earned the opportunity to be here. I feel like I belong with everyone and giving myself the best chance to compete and do well. Obviously disappointed losing. No one really likes to lose, but there's a lot to build on from there, and it's early in the season, had a good start to the year, so it's obviously a little bump in the road, but there's only up from here, so yeah.
All right, bad stuff out of the way. So the first time I encounter you, I haven't done any prep because I literally just came off the court here and we've been trying to make this happen. But what, 6-7-ish years ago? Is that about right?
Yeah, sounds
right. And I just remember thinking to myself, this guy's a little awkward looking, kind of a little different on the court. Doesn't have that like normal, you know, prototypical body shape. And I just like, I'm intrigued by this young man. So talk about those first couple of years on tour, because it was, I know it was challenging, especially coming from a small school, maybe not that huge pedigree, and just all of a sudden you're there, you're in it.
Well, let's just say I'm not the most flexible of human beings, so that's probably what gives me that persona. Yeah. But yeah, coming from a small school, kind of had a different path than most people, and I honestly was just trying to prove myself and just see what I could do. I mean, I never really had any expectation of what was possible for me. I just, let's just see how far we can take it. With my college coach, we said 2 years out of college, let's just give it everything you got. And now is year like 8 or 9, so it's been going all right. And yeah, just proving myself that I belong. I mean, my path to get to here, the slams, took a longer than most people. But yeah, it's about the journey, right? Like, I felt like I was still improving, so I kept going. Yeah.
When you were 16, what did you imagine the next, say, 10 years were going to look like?
When I was 16, I actually went to boarding school, which was not a tennis school. So college tennis wasn't even on my radar.
Really?
I was playing squash, high school tennis.
Squash?
Played a year of football in high school.
I'm sorry, I'm going to need you to pause. Football, I can understand. Squash?
I played 4 years of varsity squash and actually got to the point where my last 2 years in high school, I was playing #1 on the squash team and considered playing college squash.
Like Virginia?
Yeah, like I was in that area. That, that was the area of the country I was in, and continued, thought about going somewhere D3 maybe to play some squash or something.
There are only like five or six Division I programs that have squash. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not huge, but it's big in the Northeast and where I went to school. So, at 16, and then kind of fell in love with tennis again. I was a good junior and was burnt out, and then re-fell in love. And luckily, the Wofford coach gave me a shot because that was my only college offer. Let's quote-unquote offer. Yeah. It was basically like, be a walk-on, we'll give you the smallest amount of money possible. And he took a chance on me. So
So what caused the burnout, and then how did you refine that love at that, especially at that age?
Yeah, so in the 12s, 14s, I was a top junior in the Southeast, which was one of the stronger regions. Mm-hmm. I don't know, top 20, top 50 in the country playing. My South Carolina State alone had some of the best players in the country, like Hunter Harrington, Harrison Richmond, Stephen Bear, all these guys that were really good. And so I played a lot of tennis. Like, I was traveling like full time, almost as much as like a pro would, missing a lot of school and stuff. Yeah. And got to the point where I came to high school and I was like, I'm done with this. I've already played like a full career, and I'm 14 or 15 years old. Yeah. And obviously, like, different things play a part of that, but getting frustrated, and I was a late developer as well. So I was tiny. And so I was like, man, I'm not catching up to everyone else. Let's put this on pause for a little while.
What was your game like at that stage?
crafty. Like, I was just throwing junk and not like pushing like a kid, but I was drop shotting and coming to the net, which now has helped me in my career now. But at the time I was, just trying to be creative and drop shots and all that stuff.
Yeah. So Stefan Kozlov.
Yes. Okay. Kaz was probably way better than me at that.
Well, yeah. Kaz is a really good junior.
Yeah.
Like, super good. Okay, so then you're at this point. You're going to do some squash. You're going to play a year of football, which, again, is also a very odd contrast there. But how do you kind of just say, listen, I'm gonna give it a shot here? Obviously, we mentioned Wofford giving you that opportunity, but where does that come from to just say, you know what, I am going to give it one last look?
Yeah, I mean, tennis has been a part of my family. Like, my dad, aunt, and grandfather all played at William & Mary. They all played college tennis, were very good, and so then just found that passion and fell in love with it again. Like, let's give it one more shot, and walked on, and at Wofford, I improved. I played number 4 or 5 my freshman year, and then after that, I played number 1 my last 3 years in singles and doubles, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just finding that love again. I mean, I'm pretty fiery on court, and that actually turns into...
We're going to get to that, don't worry.
It turned into... That fire turned into passion kind of thing. Like, it helped my work ethic improve and get better. Like, that fire, I was just not content just to be there. I wanted to...
So you're playing at Wofford. I was at Illinois. I remember they came and played basketball at the State Farm Center, and I had to learn a little bit about Wofford as I was doing the public address announcing. And I imagine, it's a good area, obviously a lot of good talent down there. So you probably had some very good teammates who probably had impressive junior careers, but obviously it's not a powerhouse. So again, I'm going to ask that kind of that same question. When you're 19, 20, and you're getting to that point, you're number one on your team, you're number one singles doubles. The opportunities, though, for like NCAA tournament are very small. You don't have the opportunity to play those higher level players. How did you find that balance so that you kind of it clicked over that I can actually do this at this? This was a possibility. Okay, let's see.
Men's doubles.
Santiago not me.
Gonzalez, Neil Skupski,
Mackenzie
McDonald.
A new team.
Baltic Van de Zanschel.
That's interesting. Yeah. A Peter Lukasen matchup right in there. But how did that click over to just? Hey, I actually have this opportunity to play at a different level.
Yeah, so I was one of 7 freshmen on that team.
Yeah.
All kids that I had grown up against in the juniors when I was younger. And yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't really know how it clicked over. Like, I was just, again, just trying to prove myself. Like, that's always kind of been my thing. And I really don't know. Like, it was just, let's see how far I can take this. Like, I was lucky enough at Wofford to have my personal coach, Rob Thompson, lived in the same town. And so we were in it together at that point. It was, let's see how good we can get and improve. And I made some crazy good jumps. And, yeah. So
how?
I was practicing like a – I didn't know it at the time, but I was practicing like a professional between my freshman and sophomore years and things like that. We were doing individual work, and then we were playing sets and single sets like – 5 days a week, and we were really like, I didn't know it at the time, that, but that's what a professional train's like, but that was what we were putting into it.
Okay, so then where we started, this the first 2 years in college, what realistically was the plan? Was it strictly doubles? Was there a singles component mixed in there as well? But giving yourself 2 years, that's tough because obviously the financial component as well. How did you structure that to give yourself the best chance for success?
In college, I had no intention of playing pro.
Okay.
Like, I actually did an internship with the Charlotte Hornets when I was in college.
Okay.
Setting myself, I did another internship with a production company, manufacturing. Like, I literally had no intention to play.
Producing what? I'm going to need the answer here.
It's like packaging. It's, okay. Yeah. It's called Sunoco. It's a packaging company.
Okay.
But, yeah, I had no intention to play, and I was out of school. I wanted to play singles and doubles and see what I could do, and unfortunately, doubles took off a lot faster. My singles ranking didn't take quite as well as I wanted it to, but doubles was skyrocketing, so I was, let's see what we can do with this.
Okay, and you've done pretty well. Let's talk a little bit about the feistiness. Let's see, we have first title.
Dennis Kudla.
Tallahassee?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, sorry. Just I had to test the memory there.
Long time ago.
Yeah. You always kind of had this spiciness, and you don't look like a human being who would have some spiciness. There are times when you might be down in a set, and you'll make a little remark as you're passing a player at the chair, or maybe you'll just have a little bit more of a prolonged argument about a call to just kind of disrupt
the old me,
yeah. the old you. But I'm wondering where that came from, because again, having interacted with you over the years, that's not your personality. And how do you kind of deal with those that dichotomy?
Yeah, I mean, off the court, I'm very relaxed and don't really care too much about, like, getting stuff like that. But I love to compete, and that's what, like, everyone likes, has a thrill. People like to go skydiving, roller coasters. Like, competing is my thrill. Like, I don't need any of that stuff. Like, put me out on the court, the field. Like, I'm going to bring in my all. And unfortunately, at times, it would bring out the feisty side of me. I know it's not the best part of me, and I've actually been working on that a lot, but I do think it helped create that fire to push past some of the barriers that I maybe coming from a smaller school or smaller or my non-flexibility or like things like that. It kind of helped me drive forward in a way. Like, obviously, there were things I would not want to do, but I think it's helped me in a way.
I think so too, because I think it gave you a personality on the court that showed that you were willing to. This sounds bad, but I don't actually mean it so, but like you were willing to do whatever it took to win a match. And I think there might be an annoyance at that from other players, but also there's just that understanding that you are a competitor at the highest level.
Right, yeah. I mean, I like to at least think that I'm friends with a lot of players on tour. And, I mean, at the end of the day, like everyone knows that on court is different than outside tennis. We're fighting for a living here, especially doubles, challengers, like, the difference between first and second round is, you know, like whether you're making money or not.
Right.
So, I mean, I think I'm through that state, hopefully mostly through that stage of my career and my life. I've been the last 2-3 years invested in a mental coach, which has helped me. And I think that's one of the biggest differences that's taken me from around 100 in the world to now top 50. And it's been an investment in myself and not only in my game, but in my life, relationships, family, everything. So,
that first title with Dennis Kudla, I what I have in my head is just this almost sense of relief, because I felt you like had been continuously growing and growing, and then that was a pretty magical week for you. And obviously, Dennis, a very, very good partner. Talk about that week in particular in Tallahassee and how it kind of pushed you a little bit in your career.
Yeah, I mean, like I've said this story a couple times, is at the Tallahassee Challenger, I was applying for jobs on like in the sports world with like NBA teams. It's called Teamwork Online, and I was spending all day just applying for jobs and stuff, and then I win that tournament and I'm like, well, let's rethink things. But playing with Dennis, I mean, I was very fortunate to get a top singles guy to play with me at the time. I'd like to think I'd built some relationships with some of the coaches and some of the players at that time and put in that investment time, because it's important. And then, that sparked my belief that, hey, I can actually win a few of these things and continue to build. So.
Yeah, that relationship building, I think that component is really hard, especially when you are at a smaller school. You don't have that, you're not at national team indoors or NCAAs necessarily to really kind of have those relationships. And how, I guess where did that part come from, especially early on tour?
Yeah, I think for me it was, let's just try and be at some of these guys' matches and talk to their coaches. And if you need warm-ups, hey, I got you, and things like that. Because, yeah, I mean, I didn't play UVA or any of these schools where it's easy to have those connections or someone help you get into tournaments or things like that. So let's put yourself in the best position possible. And so, yeah, just trying to lend a hand to anyone that needs any help. And I'll come watch you. Like, we have a lot of free time in the day. Like, it's an investment. It's work as well, but it's also just – let's support each other a little bit. So.
Yeah, you and I have had many talks. What I'm going to bring up is Little Rock. Is that a year and a half ago? Is that right? We had a drink at the hotel bar.
Sounds right.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
Is that the Ben Shelton first professional tournament too? I think it was.
Yeah.
So you and I were having a drink, and I remember you were kind of at that stage where it'd been 2-3 years at that challenger level. You know exactly how hard it is to break out of that. It is very difficult. During that talk, I know you were very close to ending your career. Two-part question. What turned it around for you at that point? And also, the more big-picture question, how do we get it so there's a little bit more opportunity for doubles players to advance past that challenger level?
Yeah, I mean, I think that conversation... Yeah, it was a tough point, and I think at that point I almost became at peace with, if I make it, I make it, if I don't, I don't. There's no shame in stopping, there's no shame in not reaching a certain level, like as long as you've kind of been vulnerable and put yourself out there, and I think that's actually freed me up a little bit. Like if I reach a certain spot, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It's like how I feel at the end of the whole journey, that was it worth it, or did I leave it all out there? And so, yeah, so I'm more at peace with things. Yeah. And then that second part, that's a tough one.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
There's luckily over the last few years there has been an increase of challenger opportunities, like bigger challengers, especially for doubles players, because the point difference is crazy. I think having like challenger or 500 qualies and things like that, maybe there'll be somewhere down the road where they'll increase some of those draws and give guys a chance. But I do think now that there's like more 125s and hundreds, the gap will start to close, because you could play all challengers and be 70 in the world, and then you can get in slams without playing any tour events, which is a real possibility now on the doubles side.
Yeah.
I would say I would like the U.S. to maybe have a few bigger challengers. I think like Europe, France, some of those, or like France, Italy, some of those countries have more hundreds, 125s, and that gives guys the opportunity to make that jump. And it's tough when you're playing a lot of 75s. Like, only one or two guys can really like get all the way through. Like my current partner Julian Cash and his partner Patton, they won 10 or 11 75s, and then they
raise here for them.
Yeah, that's like unheard of.
Yeah,
and they like, you know, just got to the tour level,
right?
So it's not a realistic thing to just play those lower.
Right.
So the U.S., yeah, I wish we had a few more tournaments, bigger tournaments, but
it's so difficult right now. As I know you know this. I'm just gonna say it into the podcast world, but you know the hotel cost, the housing cost, is what is absolutely making it so difficult for all of these tournaments to get to that next level, because of the fact you're having to house everybody. Hotel costs are up, and it makes it really, really hard. Whereas in Europe, it's just a little bit cheaper.
Yeah, it's tough, and I actually miss playing challengers in the U.S. Like some of my favorite memories, and I still keep in touch with a lot of these housing families that I stay with. I mean, Winnetka, some of my favorite housing, Tiburon, all that stuff. And I think if the U.S. could kind of get back to that mindset a little bit, like offer that as to players and have good options, then maybe we could start to do it. But yeah, it's tough in the U.S. with the costs and having that. You have to provide that option. Like, yeah.
Yeah. You know there are obviously, and hopefully you're not having to actually deal with it, but you know there are some changes that have happened with Challenger points, and just really recently without a lot of, you know, advanced knowledge in terms of there's that same point level for winners, a little bit decrease as you go down. You're a thoughtful and opinionated guy. I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because I'm still processing it a little bit myself. How do you think that will change things over the next 2 years?
So I think those changes are just on the single side. Okay. I might be wrong.
That's the thing. I haven't looked yet. I haven't been around a challenger yet.
I do think there was a little, at least talking to some people on the tour and some tour managers and things like that. It basically just eliminates some guys were, first of all, let's just say the Masters events were losing second round there, second or third round, but couldn't play like one of those 175 challengers.
Here we go. If you escort to court 13, women's doubles, Ludmila Kichanov, Elena Ostapenko, Amina Bechtis, and Kayla Day.
Amina Bechtis, the pride of the University of Michigan.
Go blue. yeah, so guys could lose a couple rounds into a Masters.
Yeah.
But a guy that lost first round of that could actually go play a challenger and get more points.
Right.
And so they're trying to encourage guys to play more tour events if you've earned that ranking to actually play your kind of your level versus, I can drop down and play and get an equal amount of points. It's a big change, and obviously I wish it would have been communicated earlier.
Yes,
but
same.
In a way, I could see how it makes sense to, if you're ranked 100, 110, like, go play qualies of a 250
yes.
versus playing a challenger, because that's the goal in the sport, right?
Correct.
Is to play the biggest events. So.
It's such an interesting question, because I think for years, you can speak to this too, we were talking about we need more events. We need more events at that challenger level. Now there's a glut of events at the challenger level, right? And as a result, so the points, you know, the points of where they were 10 years ago, you know, say at 200 versus where they are now, it's almost doubled. I mean, it's crazy, and so I think they're trying to regulate.
The following players, damn it, search the match control area for your escort in court 17. Mm-hmm. Women's doubles.
Mira
Andreeva,
she's
Victoria
good.
Tomova,
okay.
Anna Blinkova,
yeah,
and Alexandra Sasnovich.
That's not a bad doubles match. But anyway,
I don't know any of those.
Andreeva just destroyed.
Jabeur.
Thank you.
Yes,
I was prepping for my match, but yeah, there's just that. There's so many more points, and now I think they're trying to flatten it out.
Yeah, and that was kind of – I've obviously have a lot of conversations with some of these tour managers, and it's great having all these challenger opportunities, like the money, the overall money is involved,
yes.
and it's great. But now it's almost like balancing out the schedule to where it makes sense, right? If there's three 250s a week, let's not have two 125s and 100. Let's maybe during like Indian Wells or something, let's have a 125 where a lot of those people can't get in, and I think that's the next step. I think it's going to take a couple of years, unfortunately. But, yeah, it's great having these opportunities. I don't think we need to keep adding too much, because then it could become oversaturated
yes.
With points and things like that. My doubles ranking is where it is, and I have almost 2,000 points. That's a lot of points to accumulate throughout the year, which is kind of scary shit.
Yeah.
But, hopefully they can kind of balance it out.
Here we go.
It's a busy time.
Men's singles.
Oh, singles. He's good.
Thomas Martin Echeverry.
Also good.
Interesting match. Yeah.
Yes. So, I have to start going and getting ready for my match, and Rachel's sitting over there. I want to ask you about what she's meant. I've gotten to know her just a little bit over the last couple of years at some various events. Just seeing what she has posted on Instagram here this week of just making sure to get out and explore and be a part of the community in this time when you're in this incredible city of Melbourne. I guess what has she meant for you personally and also especially professionally when you're out here on tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's great having someone so supportive and cares about what I do, right? And she's an athlete herself, so she understands the lifestyle, the what I need, what I don't need, let's give him space, let's not, you know, and it's been great having her here because she can go explore the city and see some of the things that I wish I could see sometimes, and yeah, I have to work and take care of my body and do all this stuff, and yeah, let's give her space to go do her thing, but yeah, I mean, let's be real, like any partner of a tennis player is a very difficult job, and her relationship, like we're traveling so much. Even when we're on the road with them, we're doing a lot. We have to be locked in. Yeah. We're not necessarily emotionally engaged. We're we have so many other emotions going through our heads. So I think it's a tough job. And no, Rachel's done a great job to be by my side, be my partner, and help me get through things. Yeah.
Who's the better athlete?
Depends on the sport. Yeah, let's leave it at that. I think that keeps everyone happy.
Okay, that's a very good answer because she's kind of a badass.
Yeah, she's good at a lot of things. So I'll stick to the tennis side. Yeah.
Roback, I mean, having them as a sponsor for you over the last couple of years, I know that that has meant a lot for you as well.
Yeah, it's cool being a part of a brand that's growing in the U.S. I'm the only tennis player. I see it all over the country in the U.S.
Too.
I see it. Everywhere I recognize it, I get a lot of people talking to me about it, and hopefully it helps them a little bit to have a player in the country club sports world. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it fits my kind of very casual, chill, like not in your face stuff. So yeah.
Okay, let's do one hard question here.
Oh, these the other ones haven't been hard. Yeah, nice.
No, the other one's just been talking about you, and that's so easy.
That's so hard.
I'm going to give you the tough one that everybody's been asked at the press conferences. Mr. Zverev. Being elected to the player council, it is a really challenging thing, and there's no domestic abuse policy. Obviously, a very difficult question, but I'm going to ask you how you have kind of had to come to grips with that as him being one of the leaders of the player council.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very touchy and tough subject to cover. I mean, I think first of all, the ATP WTA should have stuff just formally on paper that. If this happens, boom, you're not part of the, like, because obviously there's different standings within the ATP if you're on probation or if you're under investigation and things like that.
Correct.
But if there's nothing on paper, then it's obviously hard to put anything against him because there's nothing written, right? So obviously, hopefully they can get that on paper and get that on board. And then, yeah, if you're in investigation for that thing, then take you off the board. But where he's at right now, I understand that it's a tough line to cross, obviously. Yeah, I mean, if you're under investigation, you probably shouldn't be a part of it, but yeah, what do I know?
It's such a tricky subject because I think it's been really interesting, and I've just put you on the spot.
Clearly.
But the players having to answer that question, I mean, now he's been elected, so I understand why it's being asked, right? But it seems like, I think you're exactly right. There needs to be pretty clear policy making here, and it's very uncomfortable that he's potentially part of how that solution is happening.
Right, yeah, because decision-making is based on that board.
Correct.
And, I mean, whenever we have a problem on tour, we have to just go through them, basically, and how are you going to bring something like that up if it's not on paper? So it almost needs to be kind of in the, quote-unquote, bylaws. And, and if you have this going on, you can't be a part of it, and boom, and it's clear and simple, but now it's just a gray area. It's messy.
And that's what makes it so hard for you guys to answer that question. I know that I'll get in trouble for saying that, but you guys have... There's a lot of gray for you guys to deal with, especially in the midst of this type of an event. Okay. Jacob Meyer. We've gotten everybody just walking by here. And just taunting us. I guess I'll go with two things. First, do you have any questions for me? Like you are always, I always appreciate this of you. You always seem to be paying attention, which I think is an incredible thing. Like you're still tuned in to the challengers, what's happening. You're always... Like, you see a result, you'll ask a question, and I always really appreciate that. Is there anything you've ever wanted to fire at me here?
I will ask, what was your daughter Marnie's favorite experience here in Australia? Because that was looked pretty cool to have her here.
I appreciate you asking that, actually. We went to the same exhibit. I don't think you went with Rachel.
No.
This art exhibit, it was of the native people here of Australia, where it's completely immersive. On all, kind of like the Sphere in Vegas, just like all over the walls with music. And she's really getting into art right now, graphic design.
Perfect.
And so we just took a chance, a flyer on it, and she was completely engrossed in for an hour. And it's very rare for her at the age of 9 to just be like, I love this. I don't have any I'm just enjoying this experience. And that was really, and also she got to see the court from the radio booth.
It's amazing.
She doesn't even care about tennis, but she was...
Yeah, that's amazing.
That was pretty cool. Okay.
And this is not a question.
Oh, okay.
But I'm very happy to see you here because this is where you belong. You know, this is the passion and what you do for tennis, so thank you.
I appreciate that from you, and it's the same. Like, you've worked your ass off to get to this point. It took a long time to do so, and I that's what actually was going to lead to me to my last question. You did go through... all of those struggles. You have come from a smaller school. You've all of these things. What's the most enjoyable part of this for you at this stage? Because there's still stressors. Some days on court are still miserable. Some days on court are great. What really about this experience here in Melbourne, in New York, what makes it so enjoyable for you?
Yeah, I mean, this is why as a kid, when you're 7 years old in school, what do you want to do when you grow up? Is you just play professional sport, professional tennis, play Grand Slam. Like, this is where I wanted to be as a kid. So this is where I've always dreamt of being and being able to share it with my family, Rachel, like have them at a lot of the tournaments, things like that. Even people watching at home, like the Wofford men's team watches all my matches, like people that just I kind of influence in my life and be a part of. It's just been really cool just to see their reactions and know that they've helped me so much. So
you've earned this. I'm sad I don't get to see you as much, but I really do appreciate this long overdue podcast. That's on me. But I really appreciate it. Congratulations on all the success.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at MikeCTennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.